Okay, hi. Here we are on Monday again. Happens every week. Almost. Hi. All right. So, a few little things. A few things. I assume you're all recovered from Thanksgiving dinner now. I had mine last night. So. Yeah. We like to, you know, get a jump on things. So we had our family Thanksgiving dinner last night and had a great time. Wonderful food. No turkey, but it's all right. A couple of vegetarians in the group. On the screen is the registrar's announcement that the computer glitch has been repaired. And for those of you who tried to register for courses for spring at 6 o'clock this morning, somebody probably should apologize for you having gotten up at that ungodly hour and discovering that you couldn't get on the computer. And I only had one email from an advisee who assumed, of course, that it was something she was doing wrong. But when I got to the office, there it was, the registrar saying, "We don't have a clue." But they did get a clue, they did solve it. And what they have done, as it announces there, is that they have changed tomorrow. To keep it what they think is fair, I'll let them debate that with you. Nobody is being allowed to register today. So tomorrow at 6, those who thought they could register today will register. And seniors, instead of being able to get log on at 6, will be able to log on at 7. So that first hour, all of you who have graduates and the fifth year certificate people and I think Vermont Scholars and some other people. Anyway, whoever gets to register, that's your hour. And after that, it's the same. So the only change is that the people who couldn't register today will be allowed to register tomorrow morning at 6. Seniors will be delayed until 7. And most of you, I suspect, just sit back and watch until Thursday or Friday anyway, so it's no problem for you. Also note that they have changed the registration URL. Apparently that was part of the fix. They needed to change the URL, so if you have it bookmarked and can't get in, that's why, but you should get redirected to the new one anyway. Okay. There's no reason for me to ask you if you have any questions about that, because I wouldn't be able to answer them anyway, so I'm not going to bother. Another registration issue that may affect some of you, I know it affects some of you, is that we may change HDFS 60 for the spring semester, and it's about 92% certain that we will change it. It'll still be Monday, Wednesday afternoon, but the registrar couldn't fit us in a room. So they asked if we could move it an hour later, and we did a pretty thorough survey of the people who are required to take it, and I think we got everybody, and there don't seem to be any conflicts. Moving it an hour later may be a hassle for some people. And for that, if we do change it, which I suspect will happen, rather than meet out in the cold in the winter, I suggested that since I've been here longer than any other faculty member, I should get my first choice. And nobody listened. So if you're planning to take 60, be aware that if you have a nice, neat schedule set up, when you log on, tomorrow or the next day or the next day, it may be at a different time, and but still Monday, Wednesday, just an hour later. Okay, that one I could answer questions about, but there probably aren't any. If Talia arrives, we will give the exams back at the end of class. Are you here? No. Okay. So, if you would like, when she shows up, you feel free to engage in an outburst of spontaneous applause. If she doesn't show up, I'm going to run. So, all right. Any other questions, or are we just ready to have fun? You're just ready to have fun. All right. I was talking about attachment, those emotional connections between people that begin in infancy, for which we are wonderfully evolved when we arrive in the world. We are ready to get connected to other people, and our survival depends on having at least one other person, at least well enough connected to us to care about whether or not we survive. And in the process of helping us survive, caregivers and infants typically create a preference for each other and develop a transaction that becomes emotionally charged and involves a series of changes in each person that make the infant more likely to engage in all of these behaviors that attract attention from adults. If the attachment process is working, it involves the adult engaging in the adult side of the transaction. That means trying to meet the infant's needs, figuring out what's wrong, being appropriate and timely and consistent in those responses. And then as the attachment and the interest and the curiosity about the infant develops, adults who are trying to establish a bond with the child will engage in non-necessary, non-essential activities so that they're having fun with the child. There are other ways to engage in non-essential activities. Don't let me give you the notion that all this is hunky-dory fun, because you can do non-essential things by annoying babies. You can take candy out, or the nipple out of their mouths. You can poke them, you can pinch them, you can scare them, you can growl at them, you can throw them around. There are all kinds of non-essential things that caregivers can do. We don't recommend them, and they will have an impact on the attachment process. They will result in an infant who rejects attachment with you because you're scaring it, you're annoying it, you're hurting it. But caregivers have choices about which kinds of caregiving activities and they engage in and how they engage in them. So parents are not necessarily wired to do it right. And if they have been badly parented themselves in previous generations, they are more likely to engage in behaviors that are not going to result in a nice, solid, warm, fuzzy, wonderful, close attachment with the infant. So bad parenting can begin as soon as a child is born or before, and it can have its roots in previous generations of inappropriate, we think, our label for it, inappropriate parenting behaviors. So don't assume that all parents do it well, because that isn't the case. What happens, though, when the infant begins to be well attached with an adult who is doing things right, is that we get an infant who shows that attachment by wanting to be with the familiar adult. It doesn't want the familiar adult to leave. It's happy when the familiar adult comes back. And it provides, as I was saying when we finished on Wednesday, it provides a secure base. The presence of the attachments figure, the one that you're attached with, gives you the freedom to explore, gives you the confidence and the security to reach out, to stretch yourself, to explore, take risks, try new things. And if we look at the long-term consequences of being attached, we see trying to be close to the person you're attached with, attempts to engage in transactions, modification of your behavior to promote appropriate transactions and prolong them, protest when you have to be separated, and grief when you lose that person. Let me go back and say one other thing about both of these slides. This is a definition of what the baby does, but it also is a description of what the adult does. The adult demonstrates that he or she is attached with the infant by having a clear preference for being with his or her own infant. Strangely enough, people get picky about what babies they hang out with, and they would prefer to hang out with their own as they become attached with them. They don't like it if you take their babies away from them. They're happy when you bring their baby back to them. And I'm not sure about the last one. I'm not sure if parents have a secure base to explore if the baby is present. But let me suggest anecdotally that I think that may be true, because if you watch what mothers particularly, but also fathers, when a baby is absent from them, if you watch them, you see their anxiety interfere with the things that they think they are supposed to be doing. So maybe it's not the exploring that gets interrupted by the absence of the familiar parent in this case, but maybe it's the ability to engage in your everyday activities efficiently and effectively when the baby that you're attached with or the child that you're attached with is absent. Anecdotally, I've seen that a number of times because the parent is worried and you simply aren't motivated. Or for some of us, when you're child is in the hospital or absent or not home because it's somewhere else and you're worried about it, you're distressed by that, some of us engage in compulsive house cleaning or things to keep us busy, to keep our minds off the fact that we're worried about the child. But that's not necessarily efficient or effective or free engagement in the activities that we would like to engage in. So when the baby comes back, when we get the kid back from the hospital or the child shows up from whatever absence, whatever has caused its absence, then parents relax and they can engage in their lives again. So I guess to some extent, well, maybe it's not the ability to explore, but the ability to engage in your normal activities is enhanced by knowing where your child is and knowing that your child is safe. Some of you have parents who are very attached to you, and they wake up in the middle of the night and they're worried about you. No matter what you're doing, no matter how safe you really are, it bothers them that you're not there. And I know that from watching my beloved wife wake up in the middle of the night, wake me up, and worry about where her daughters are, especially if the roads are bad. Okay, I suggested that parents come in different stripes, different costumes, and The text describes four styles of attachment, and the first three of those are derived from work of Ainsworth, who created some really diabolic techniques for looking at toddlers and their mothers, and studied a large number of kids over a large period of time. And she saw what she described as parenting styles that lead to particular flavors of attachment. And then a fourth, she described three, and I'm going to describe those, and then the text describes a fourth that has been added as people have continued that kind of research. I'm not going to belabor these because they're well described in the text, but what you're looking for is Ainsworth, and one of the styles that she saw was a parent who was rejecting, a parent who avoids close contact. You don't have to write this down. They're in the text. They're very clear. And I'll put, I don't think these are up on the, and I was about to ask Talia to see, you see me get anxious because she's not here. She can't take the note that I want her to take, which is, would somebody please email me, remind me to put these on the website? Okay. These are parents, and she studied them. She studied them in their homes with their infants, and this is what she saw while they were being studied. Parents who, mothers particularly, who don't like close contact with their babies, who think babies are a bother, show irritability when they have to deal with their babies, did not modify their behavior to meet the infant's needs. They do their own thing. Baby needs something. Baby needs to shape up. They typically see the infant as an intrusion into their own life. And they're predictable, but they're not contingent. Contingent means that their actions are contingent upon or immediately following the baby's behavior. And what you see in rejecting parents is that they're really not engaged in a dance with the baby. They're engaged in their own thing. The baby's here, and the baby's doing its thing, and the parent is doing his or her thing, and they're not creating that wonderful tango or waltz or... you don't know about those dances, do you? You know, where two people dance, and they're together, and they're actually holding each other, and it's fluid movement, coordinated. You don't know. You know about mosh pits, right? Raves. That's what this parent is doing. What one dancer is doing has nothing to do with what the other dancer is doing. That's what you're learning in the mosh pit. Okay. All right. Then there were what she called the accepting parents. These are people who like their babies, they respond appropriately and contingently, they enjoy the contact, they meet their own needs and the baby's, and they typically put the baby's needs first. That's a problem for some people. And they modify their own behavior. They adjust what they're doing to prolong the activity with the infant. So they're not focused on themselves, they're not egocentric. They're watching the baby and they're trying to create a dance with the baby. They're the ones who are waltzing and they're having fun with the baby. That kind of behavior leads typically to a fairly secure attachment with the baby. Others are ambivalent. They create some anxiety, and they have some anxiety in the parenting that they're doing. They're not secure about it. They're not sure what they're doing. In the interviews and the observations, it was interesting because these were the parents who would ask a graduate student what he or she thought of. This is a person who's sitting there observing. They would ask for advice from the graduate student about whether or not the graduate student thought they were doing a good job or what they should they do something different? Is my baby normal? That kind of anxiety that causes people to question their own behavior and the baby's normality. And people who do that, some of you have parents who are like that. You know, they're anxious and they bug you and they're intrusive. And they're not very consistent. Well, these parents are not secure. They're not sure about what they're doing. And they lead infants to become unsure about the parent. So they're ambivalent. And sometimes these parents are trying to draw the child in really, really close and encouraging the child to be dependent on the parent. So they're not teaching the infant or the toddler things that might be useful, but they're expecting the infant to be dependent on them so they can do all of the work. And at other times, they're kind of distant. Yes? Oh, nothing from personal experience here, please. Yes, the question is, do parents occasionally show different attachment styles and parenting styles with different parents? Of course they do. Some parents really don't like boy babies. Some parents have babies with difficult temperaments, and they find it difficult to create a smooth transaction, a comfortable transaction, with a child. And with another child in the same family from the same parents, they may have an easy kid or a slow to warm up kid who's very easy to create the dance with. So parents are creating a transaction to which the infant is contributing its own personality. And if the parent is not comfortable with the child's style, with its temperament, it may be doing quite different things than it is with another baby with whom it has more synchrony, more similarity, at least more appreciation. So parents discriminate on the basis of temperament. That may lead to discrimination on the basis of gender. And by discrimination, I don't mean they're shutting one baby out necessarily. Intentionally, it's just that they're building different kinds of relationships. And it is fully a transaction between the infant's behavior and the adult. We are all, when we parent, when we take care of a child, we're all trying to create a comfortable relationship, a transaction, with the particular child we're engaged with. And since the child comes at us with different preferences, different responsiveness, different intensities, we are developing a different relationship with each child. So parents can be quite different with different children. There are other, sometimes more pathological situations where parents do fairly actively reject a child and don't engage with it, either because of something going on in the parent's life at the particular time, or something that's going on in the triad created by the child with the parents. And the child may be simply in the wrong place, in the wrong relationship at the wrong time. And I can think of, my tendency is to try to think of the worst case scenario that I've run into. Probably the worst case scenario I've run into is a mother who had done a really, really good job creating a fairly close bond with two children in the family, got pregnant the third time, and her husband had an affair during that pregnancy, and the first two, I don't need the detail, but I don't want you to be able to identify them. So the third child came along, and the mother and father were having a major spat in their life, which included him leaving and not coming back. And as she said in the clinic, when the child finally got to the clinic at about four, everything about this child reminded her of his father. And it was very clear that she had been taking out her anger at the father on this poor little defenseless kid who just happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time with the wrong father. So her attachment was very different with them. That's probably the worst case scenario I've seen.
Are these parents, like ambivalent parents, first child, that can go on more usually than the second?
Not really. The question was whether the firstborn is more likely to have an ambivalent parent. No, they're more like firstborn parents of firstborns, and by the way, all of Ainsworth's are firstborns, so she sort of controls for that. Firstborns get parents who are sometimes not sure of their own capabilities, and they may be a little anxious about that, but assuming that they're doing a reasonably good job, they are typically so infatuated and in love with being parents and having this child that, you know, they just lose it. And they're with the kid all the time. What you have to do with parents of firstborns is tell them that by the time the child is two, they really can leave the kid with a babysitter. And they're not with the kid all the time because they're anxious, they're just with the kid because they don't have anything else to do. Second kid comes along, they've got other things to do. We second children, fortunately, don't have to suffer having parents who are in our faces all the time. And if we're really lucky, then we have a younger sibling or two, so we become middle children and we get neglected and forgotten, which lets us do our own thing and become independent. And you know, middle children. How many of you are middle children? I like you all, the middle children, right? You are flexible. You're adaptable. You've learned to negotiate in both directions. You have big siblings who are more powerful than you, so you learn to negotiate with them. And then you have little siblings, and you learn to take care of them, and you negotiate with them. And we become diplomats and psychologists and mediators, and because we're comfortable in that role, and we're flexible and adaptable and cuddly and warm and all of that sort of stuff. And I think it's because we get neglected by our parents and have all of these other roles available to us. Poor firstborns, they don't have anybody but parents who are so powerful you can't negotiate with them. And the younger ones who don't have anybody who's not bigger than they are, so they're, well, you know how you are. Okay, I'm not going there. We will talk about that and read about that in 60, though. The constellation or birth order effects. But thank you for that question. If you look at the babies of these three kinds of parents, what happens if you have the parent who doesn't like you is that when you put them in this room, you bring them into the lab and you put the baby and the mother in the room you watch them for a while. It's called the strange situation. It really is a strange, odd situation. Everybody's uncomfortable in it. So it's kind of a bizarre sort of thing that Ainsworth invented. And she measured how far the kids went and how many feet away from the mothers they got and interactions with everybody. And then after a while, you bring a graduate student in who gets to sit for a while, and then the mother leaves, and that's the really strange thing. And you watch what the kid does when mother gets up and says, "I'll be back," and goes out the door. And then if the kid gets distressed, the poor graduate student, I hope these people got their degrees, but they really suffered for it. The kid gets distressed, and the graduate student has to pick them up and try to comfort them, and then you watch what happens when mom comes back. It's an interesting situation. And the text describes it in a little more detail. So what happens when you don't like your mother, or she doesn't like you, or you don't have much of a relationship with her, is you come into this setting and the kid goes off over there and plays with the toys and ignores mom. And when mom leaves, you don't care. And so you spend as much time talking to the stranger as you do mom, and when mom comes back, you stay with the stranger. And sometimes these kids will be directly annoyed with mom, and these are 18-month-olds, 15 to 18-month-olds, and they'll give you in no uncertain terms the body language that says, "Okay, you're back, whatever." And there's no huggy kissy, no, "I'm glad you're here, I'm relieved you still exist." You know, "There you are, I was happy with the stranger, it was okay." With the accepting parents, what you get is a kid who explores once he or she is comfortable. They like their mom, they talk back and forth, they play with mom, they share toys with mom. And when the stranger comes in, they will engage the stranger only if mom indicates that that's okay. Okay, you can share your toy with the stranger, show him what you're doing, that kind of thing. And when the infant gets distressed, the stranger is not effective in calming the child. So this is the kid who, securely attached with mom, will not play with strangers at this point in life, and wants mom back. And when the parent comes back, then the infant, the toddler, goes to the mom and stays in mom's arm or in arms or in mom's lap until she calms down. And if the kid isn't distressed when mom comes back, if the kid has self-calmed, which some kids will do, then the kid is happy mom is back and there's a greeting. So what the parent has done to create this relationship affects how the child deals with this really odd situation. And when you're the ambivalent parent, what you see in the infant is that the kid doesn't want to separate from you, so you've created this little leech velcroed to you, who's not confident about new situations, even if you're there, but doesn't interact with you much, doesn't share toys with you, because the kid's not really playing with the toys, going out and getting them and bringing them back to show you. So it's not a happy, okay, we're in the world and I like the fact that you're here, I'm going to explore it. The kid with the ambivalent parent is much more likely to cling to the parent and not engage in the activities. So they're not getting the experience in the world and they don't have anything to share with the parent. So they're creating this nice little connection with each other that is going to stifle the kid's ability to learn. They're not comfortable with the stranger even when mom is holding them. And when they're distressed, and neither mom nor the stranger is particularly useful. So what you have is you've created a monster who's going to hang on you and not learn and not explore and not be comforted by you. So good luck. So you don't want that. I don't want you to have that. You don't want that. The fourth kind is a more hostile kind of attachment with the parent, and I'll let you read about that in the text. I don't want to go into that in great detail. Okay, so what I'm suggesting is that what the transactions are like that the parent sets up with the infant are variable. And not all of us get parents who are really good at creating a dance that we can grow in and contribute to. Now, if you're a constructivist, what you're seeing is the first kinds of relationships, the attachments that you're going to create. What do you do with those? You're going to continue to meet people the rest of your life, hopefully. You're going to continue to have to establish some kind of transaction with teachers, with other caregivers, with siblings, eventually with friends. And if you're a good constructivist, you assume that the infant and toddler are creating a template, a scheme that they're going to apply to new relationships. So you assume that there's, at least as the next step, the kid who has a nice secure relationship with mom and dad is going to create a nice secure one with the nanny, is going to create a nice secure relationship with the constant caregiver, with the kindergarten teacher, with the first grade teacher, with the second grade teacher. They're going to keep on doing that because they have this nice secure base that's been established, while the infant who's had a rejecting parent is going to go out and have a relationship with anybody who comes along. They're not wary of strangers, but they're also not going to get particularly attached.
What's the
The question is what happens when the caregiver changes, and that depends in part on whether it's a temporary or permanent change, whether it's an anticipated change, and whether the kid has had other caregivers along the way. So, what you have to begin to tease out is how many relationships the infant has had and how secure or ambivalent have they been. So if you have had one, say with mother, and then you form another one with daddy who's there half the time, you can have those two. If you have perhaps child care provider who's there normally, you're in infant care, but you have the same constant one. The kid may be establishing three secure relationships and developing the ability to continue. So the kid goes to preschool and develops a relationship with the preschool teacher, gets attached to grandma somewhere along the line or grandpa, you know, all of those things. So you have to look at the individual history for the child. But what happens with a secure attachment, if you end it, you take mom away, is you get grief after, you know, 9 or 10 months, because the familiar person that you have the specific attachment with is gone. And you'll see kids who've only had one attachment, particularly, they don't have the others. Now you try to start a new one, you bring in a new caregiver, that caregiver has an infant or a toddler who is distressed and upset, has a secure attachment with somebody else, and is going to resist a new one. So you're creating a transaction with a very different creature than you had at the beginning because this attachment has been lost. If you know you're going to be gone, you bring in this person to share that attachment. So the child is developing an attachment with another person, as it is perhaps with father or with the caregiver. Those are continuing attachments, and they will help the child deal with the loss of the figure that they've been attached with. Okay. So the possibilities for individual histories are just immense. What you often see is a kid who's only had one, and the next one is going to be really difficult. It's going to take a long time. It doesn't mean the kid can't. If you have established one relationship, if you have become attached to one person, particularly if it's a secure attachment, you have, I think, from a constructivist point of view, created a skill that will last you the rest of your life. Just one. That's all it takes to make you human. You can be human. Just one person during the first couple of years. But ideally, in our society at least, and in many others, you want other people to come into this child's life, and the more of those you have, the easier it is for other people to take over if mom disappears, or if dad disappears. That suggests that moms should not be doing it alone, because they're placing the infant and toddler at risk if something happens with them. Probably we all need 3 or 4 parents, or at least caregivers. And there's no evidence at all that kids can't establish close attachments with a variety of people. The hard ones, the really hard ones, the Russian babies, the Romanian babies, the ones that you read about now, the really hard ones are the ones who have no attachment figure. They have never had the opportunity to create an attachment with anybody, and then at 3, they show up on an airplane, and here they are. And they've missed all of that transaction building, and they've learned skills of keeping themselves safe and secure, which often involve rejecting other people. But if you're growing up in an overcrowded orphanage with incompetent or overworked, you don't have to be incompetent, but overworked people who know you're going to be leaving, and they've got 100 of you, they're not going to create attachments with you. And in some child care situations, in orphanages particularly, staff are forbidden to establish close relationships with individual children. It's not good for them. It's one of those things. From a therapeutic point of view, from a clinical point of view, the sensitive time to develop these skills of transaction with emotional closeness is in the first year. And if it doesn't happen, you're at risk. Because you have to unlearn some things that you've learned, and you have to establish transaction later. So you don't want, if you only have one, you want to add some more. If there's a possibility the child isn't going to establish any, you want to give that child the possibility as early as possible. And the earlier you have the opportunity to have a specific person that you have the ongoing transaction with, the better. So early adoption is best if a kid doesn't have parents. Individual foster care is next best, so that the kid is with somebody who's establishing a relationship with it individually. Even if you have to change that later and take the kid, if you've had that one and then you end that one and you take it away and give the kid to somebody else, at least the kid has the skill. You still have to go through the grieving process for the loss, but you have the skills to add to that, the possibility. So the ones that you worry about are the ones who get up to two and have never had an individual close relationship. But all the other combinations work reasonably well. You know, kids who are communally reared with six caregivers learn to be cuddly with everybody, or at least all six of them, and they learn the skills that they need. That's an important, a very important question, because in the literature, in the popular press, you often see comments and claims from studies about the importance of early attachment. And sometimes they're right, sometimes I have issues with them, but the basic condition for being human is to have one person that you can create that closeness with in the first couple of years. If you've got that, you can have all kinds of other things happen to you. I'll give you a quick case study, a kid I worked with. I worked with him when he was 14. What had happened to this kid was that he was born into a normal family. And when he was about a year and a half old, his mother died. And so the next 3 years, 2.5 years, he was raised by his oldest sister. It was a fairly large family. And she decided she'd had enough of being the mother, so she left the family at 16 when he was about 3, 3.5. She got married and left. And so he was with his father and his brother at that point. His mother had died when he was a year and a half, giving birth to his younger brother. So he had this younger brother. So he'd lost his mother, and then he lost his big sister. And then when he was about 4.5, his father decided he couldn't do it anymore, so he left the two boys on an orphanage doorstep, literally, and with a note explaining who they were and where they'd come from, and a statement that said, "I can't raise them, don't try to find me, you won't." And they didn't. So, the two little boys, and at this point he's lost both of his female caregivers and his mother. They put the two boys in a foster home, and that worked really well, but I've forgotten the details. One of the foster parents died suddenly. I forgot whether it was mother or father. So they went back to the orphanage. They found them another placement together, And if it was the mother who died, it was the foster father in the next setting, a year and a half later, who got sick, back to the orphanage. Next placement, they couldn't find somebody who would take both boys, so they split them up. So we got a 7-year-old, 8-year-old, who has now lost everybody. Everybody he's ever tried to become attached to. But he had that basic when he started, and he had the little brother. Next, they put him in a group home. Strangely enough, he set fires. That's what kids who don't have continuing attachments often do when they have difficulty expressing their anger directly. They burn things down. Fire setting is a wonderful but very frightening kind of behavior. And so he couldn't stay there, so they put him in a therapeutic group home, which he also set on fire. And so at 11, he ended up in the institution where I was working. I was there. I came in just for the summer when he was 14. And I was asked to focus specifically on him. He was normal in every way, except he wouldn't get close to anybody, period. He'd had it. But the theory is he had had those attachments, and even though he'd lost them, he had the capability of establishing new ones. And he did. And he got fairly close with me until he discovered I was leaving at the end of the summer to go back to school, and sort of he'd missed that along the way, that I was only there for 3 months. So he kind of got nasty for a little bit until we could explain that it wasn't about him. It was about me. I had to go back to school. And at that point, his therapist was able to use the fact that he was annoyed with me, indicated he was attached with me. He hadn't been annoyed with anybody for 3 years. He hadn't gotten close to anybody. So the fact that he was annoyed at me meant he was attached. That at 14, he was becoming adolescent. He was quite self-reflective. He was formal operational at that point, at least getting there. So he was able to begin to use therapy and review his history. And the report that I got later was that that was the breakthrough for him, and he began to be able to become attached with people again. Not because I had done anything specific, I had just been with him, given him the opportunity to establish that connection with me. But he had the capability. It was there. He wanted it. He just restricted himself from doing it because of all the losses that he'd had. But it was a nice demonstration that if you've had them, you know how to do that. And if you can understand that all these people are leaving you not because of you, but because of them, and it's not about you, then you can get over your grief and go on. And in his case, 3 kids, happy marriage, career, he's in great shape. He's one of the success stories. He doesn't burn things down anymore. Okay, so if you're the constructivist, you assume that, this is on the website, so don't write it all down. You assume that what the child is doing is creating the foundation for then creating a whole bunch of more relationships, and that you will take the style that you've developed into the next relationships and maybe refine it and maybe establish slightly different kinds of relationships. One of my favorite theorists, Harry Stack Sullivan, I'll talk about if we have time, maybe Wednesday. Sullivan says that development is the process of creating a broadening repertoire of relationships with people. From starting with mom and going out to other family members and then people of different ages and then partners and then really odd kind of thing to do, establish attachments with your own children and grandchildren who are very different from you in some ways and very different in age. But what you're doing is building a repertoire of being able to establish relationships that are comfortable with a large variety of people. So think about what happens when you come to UVM? Remember this? Bowlby's phases of attachment. He says that infants start with this indiscriminate sociability. Then they have what he calls attachments in the making. I know. So I'm reading it. I don't know which way to go with this. I can. Is that better? You can read it now? Okay. Attachments in the making, and then some clear-cut attachments, and then eventually what he calls goal-coordinated partnerships, you know, a parent-child relationship that actually works, where you can use the parent and change your behavior to keep that relationship going. Think about what happens when you come to UVM as a first-year student. Is this what you see? You come into this setting. Indiscriminate sociability. Tell me about the first month. Everybody, right? You want to meet everybody. And you're meeting your roommates and you're... I know you're not, but a lot of people are trying to establish connections with people, and they do it through completely inappropriate behaviors. We call them hooking up. You call them hooking up. And that kind of dangerous, disastrous stuff. It's indiscriminate sociability. Anybody will do, right? Then you begin to show some attachments in the making. You begin to want to be with particular other people, preferably ones that you've not hooked up with before and not made a fool of yourself with before. So, new people. And then you begin to establish some specific clear-cut attachments. We're in November. How many of the first-year students are partnered up? Yeah. It won't last through Thanksgiving, but at least, you know, you're doing it, and you're happy to have somebody that you can count on at least a little bit. And eventually, not yet, but eventually, you'll form goal-oriented, goal-coordinated partnerships, yeah, where you're actually not anxious about it, and you're not now, senior year. And then those won't last either because you graduate and go someplace else. My point is that what you're doing is creating attachments, and the process of creating attachments is the same whether you're an infant or whether you're a 22-year-old. And I've been there. I was 22. I was single when I was in my 40s. Same thing. You're creating attachments with new people. So what do? Oh, well. None of that. But you might think about flirting at parties. How much is like what the infant is doing? Right? Yeah, just think about it. Not too hard. Just think about it a little bit. Okay. What happens when you're an adult and you begin to develop an attachment with somebody? This is what the infant stuff looks like. Proximity seeking, right? Why don't you come over tonight? Can we get together? Let's have lunch. Attempts to engage in transactions. What are you doing? The phone in your ear, right? You're creating a transaction. What are you having for lunch? You're doing your homework? What's going on in the library? And where are you going to be later? Initiating transactions. Modification of your behavior to promote and prolong desired transactions. Don't leave me, baby. That's a quote. The song. Separation protest. How many of you next week are going to have separation protests? Do you have to go for the whole week? Yes, you do if you're a first-year student or second-year because you live on campus, right? There's no... But one of you lives in an apartment and is going to stay here. Why can't you stay with me? Yeah. Separation protest. And, of course, there's grief at loss. So the attachment process is the same across the lifespan. Okay. Right. just substitute partner for preferred adult. You prefer the one you're partnered with, right? You're supposed to, anyway. Prefer the one you're partnered with. That's why you're partnered. Distress when the person leaves, joy when she comes back. Does your relationship, if it's secure, provide you the security to explore? Not other relationships. No. But to explore other things. One of the marks of a mature relationship is that the support that you get in it, if it's secure, the support that you get in it for growing, for developing, for being who you are, allows you to explore. People who are in relationships that are secure and mature give each other the confidence to take risks, not about relationships, but about life, to try new things, to engage in self-exploration. What kind of person am I? Do I really like this job? Your partner, if it's a secure relationship, encourages that kind of self-examination and examination of your life and will give you the support. Why don't you try it? Why don't you try it? Why don't you stretch yourself? Why don't you write that book you've been thinking about writing? Or why don't you publish your poetry or whatever it is? But we talked about this with infants. But it goes for partners as well. How do you judge your partners? Sensitivity in recognizing their needs, right? Is their response appropriate? Is it timely? Is it consistent? Are there non-essential interactions? Not too many of them. Get off the cell phone. But does the person remember what you're doing and give you a rose because you have an exam? And remember, guys like flowers. Okay? So give them flowers. Bake cookies, or whatever it is. Okay? Are there non-essential? Yes, if you're trying to establish a secure relationship with somebody, you do all of those things. And when you don't do them, the relationship is in trouble. So you can think about all of the kinds of attachments. How do you behave as a partner? Now, there's an interesting wrinkle when you get into adulthood or the kinds of places where you are, youth. Because you're trying to create an attachment relationship with somebody who is essentially a peer. And each of you has an attachment history. So what happens when two people who have the skills and the experience of having secure attachments get together and decide they want to try being partners for a while? I recommend that. Latching on to somebody who knows how to have a secure attachment. What happens when you've been rejected by your parents, so you're not comfortable with close relationships, and you partner up with somebody who's ambivalent, who isn't comfortable if you're not clingy and dependent? That relationship is going to be a miserable transaction. So what we see here and at the counseling center, I'm told, is people who are trying to partner up, one of whom doesn't want to be close at all and has an attachment style that says, don't get too close to me, I don't need you, you know, I want somebody but I don't want them real close. And they're trying to partner with somebody who's really ambivalent and insecure and anxious about attachment relationships and needs constant reassurance. And at least to be on your psychological lap all the time. They drive each other nuts. It's terrible. So don't do that. The good ones are people who both grew up rejecting, being rejected, so they don't like close attachment. So you know them. You know, they're very, very happy with their relationship because they're partnered, so they don't have to answer questions. They're partnered. Of course, the partner's in California, and they see each other twice a year, but that's enough because it takes the place of a real attachment. They've got one. Everybody gets off their back because they have this relationship that's very long distance, and they're both happy with it. Because neither of them really wants a relationship. They don't want to have the responsibility of that. You can put together your friends, figure out their attachment styles as children, interview them if you want, if they'll let you, and figure out how they grew up and why they're having so much difficulty in their attachments now. And then figure out what kind of parents they're going to be. Remember that if you're going to raise children, you want at least one of the parents to be able to have secure relationships and to know how to do that. So if you're not a secure attachment kind of person, then you want to find a partner who is, who will help you figure out how to do that and can be the primary caregiver for the children that you might bring into the world. Do I have Italia? I don't have Italia. Okay. I'll keep talking. She has the exams. Italia. Okay. She'll be here in 3 minutes. So let me occupy your time. Questions about attachment? And attachment fun?
Can you change attachment?
Can you change? The question is, can you change the kind of attachment style you have? There are two kinds of constructivists. There are the kinds who are pessimistic. I'm going to go ahead and answer the question. Let her get her breath, okay? Let her get her breath. The question is, can you change? And there, as I said, there are two kinds of constructivists. There are the kinds who say that what you got at the beginning, set the foundation, that's it, you're done. I'm an optimist, and I believe that people keep developing. And I'm pretty sure that you can change what resulted from early transactions, and I'm going to make this a blanket statement of any kind, by having transactions that encourage a different kind of style for you. So what that means is if you know that you have a lot of difficulty creating a secure attachment, then you want to find people who don't have difficulty so that you can have transactions with people who are behaving in an effective way to create the kind of transaction that you would like to have, and you enlist their help. You enlist their help. So you put out on the table that I have difficulty when I behave in a squirrely fashion. Help me. Tell me what would be more helpful for you. Okay. So what that means is you can change what happened to you when you were younger. You don't have to parent the way your parents parented. But what it means is that you have to be deliberate about that, and you have to know that it takes transactions that are going to help you create a new way of transacting. It's not going to happen just because you want it to. It's not going to happen because you think you should change. It's not going to happen even if you declare you're different. You have to construct a different way of being from the transactions that you experience. And that's what development is all about. Having transactions that create the ways that you know how to behave and to relate. Okay. The drill. You have a choice. Remember, I gave you a choice last time. It was not a commitment for today. You've had a chance to think about it. We can dump and run, or we can do it in an orderly fashion. How many of you want orderly? Okay, then Z. Reverse alphabetical. Okay. See if you can find people. Okay? A. K.
I thought we were Z. You said Z.
Yes, you are, but she has... I'm just giving them out. Okay? So you can find. A. K. J. Last name.
You have an L?
L. L.
I don't
have an L. Talia has the L.
Okay.
K. A. W. Talia has the W, but W should be right down here. B. C. C. B. Who's an A? H.
We're C.
You're C. Way up there.
Sweet.
D. E.
I'll pick F.
I'll pick A.
F.
Where am I going?
Oh, about in the middle. You're an H.
I'm an F.
H right here.
H right there.
I'm an A.
Okay. You're an A.
I'm an E.
G. I. D. D. I. J. D. I. J.
I.
DJ. DJ. J. No J's. No J's.
I'm a J.
You're a J. Yeah. There you go. Okay.